Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Lucas Beira. Thank you, Lucas. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks very much, Emma, and good job on the pronunciation of that surname. That's great. So I guess today the purpose of the webinar really and the reason that I set out to present this was trying to enhance the results that we get in practice from, you know, one of the most fundamental tests we have available in orthopedics, and that's the X-ray, the orthopedic radiograph. We're all performing radiographs in day-to-day activity, whether we've got an orthopedic bent or not, and it's clearly something that brings a lot to practice, and it's something that I think we can all strive to improve upon to enhance our results. We're going to look at covering sort of five broad topics through the next hour and a bit. We'll begin with some of the principles. Many of those principles will be familiar from your training through vet school, and we'll sort of talk about some of the relevant aspects of digital radiography and where those principles need to be stressed. We'll then move on to some tips and tricks when it comes to radiographic technique and positioning and enhancing the images that we get. We'll briefly look at some common radiographic errors or those errors that are perhaps a little bit more unique to digital radiography as age and technology is changing. We'll cover some common orthopedic conditions, those that I think you should be very familiar with and have a good grasp upon, and then we'll finish off at the end with some brief points about how we can enhance second opinions, either from your colleagues within the practice or looking at utilising a teleradiology service or your local referral centre. To begin, when we look at the value of a diagnostic radiograph, it's immense. There are benefits to the client and the animal. We can enhance client confidence in our ability when we get a useful and diagnostic radiograph. We can reduce future morbidity to our patients by identifying problems early and instituting appropriate treatment plans. And then we can potentially reduce the cost to our clients down the line if we're able to minimize costly and perhaps sometimes unnecessary further investigations. There's also the value of a useful and diagnostic radiograph to yourself and your team around you. It enhances our professional confidence, our satisfaction in the work that we do. It's an opportunity for professional development. You know, every radiograph we obtain and every new diagnosis we make is adding to our bank of knowledge and helping us with, familiarity in conditions that we're likely to see in the future. And then, principally and the absolute fundamental element of all this is getting an opportunity to treat a specific condition and hopefully being able to institute a tailor-made plan for that individual. I think it's very common to come away from investigating a lameness with a radiograph that really isn't diagnostic and fails to identify the specific problem and find that we're diagnosing soft tissue concerns. If you're coming away with a soft tissue lameness regularly, you're probably missing something because, true soft tissue pathologies are reasonably rare in day-to-day causes of lameness. The principles that I always think of, and I'm quite a self-deprecating person when it comes to all of this, I think that we always want to strive to do our best. That's clearly why we set out to become a vet and to work in practice. In doing that, we want to always critically appraise what we're doing. We want to look at what's going wrong if we think that there's something we can do better, and we want to look at finding solutions in what we're doing. Some of the common radiographic technique errors that we encounter is problems with adequate restraint. Now, that can be due to animals that are fractious or poorly sedated or poorly anaesthetized. It can be our own doing if we are trying to cut costs and obtain radiographs without sedating our patients. There are errors that are commonly around poor positioning. It's very sort of frequent that a radiograph will be submitted to the referral centre and will be asked to provide an opinion, and there'll be comments in the history that we couldn't obtain the right positioning for this reason and for that reason. And I think in the great majority of cases, it really is our own limitations and our own inexperience in practicing proper positioning and making sure that we're persistent and trying to enhance the radiographs that we're obtaining. True pathologic joint restriction, so true pathologies that are interfering with an ability to properly extend a leg for positioning, is actually quite rare. And I think most of the time it's just not having in your armory a good set of techniques for getting that positioning spot on. So we'll cover some of that in the future slides. And then some of the issues that have been introduced, I think, more commonly now with digital radiography over our original techniques are poor exposures, inadequate labeling, or problems with image processing, pre and post processing once we submit the image to our PACS system. We really need to continue to focus on ensuring that our exposures are appropriately tailored to the individual area and to that individual animal. We want to avoid an over-reliance on the digital software manipulation, because when we start to manipulate the image to enhance a poor exposure, a lot of valuable diagnostic information is lost, and this starts to impede our ability to get a diagnosis. Other common causes of a non-diagnostic radiograph here, so not necessarily a technique failure, but these are perhaps an approach issue where failing to image the affected location, and that's, you know, often the case when we can't quite localize a lameness, and I'll be the first to admit that localizing many causes of lameness on a physical examination can be very challenging. It can be challenging due to the animal's disposition, it can be challenging because it's subtle, or it can be challenging because we are gaining that clinical experience to make it more get more confident. There's a failure to get an orthogonal projection. So when I presented this to my wife last night, she sort of looked at me dumbfounded as to what an orthogonal view was. And you know, this is a second view. We always want to get a radiograph of the affected area in the orthogonal plane, the 90 degree plane. There really is no good reason to not achieving that. We're just cutting corners and potentially missing useful information in doing so. And when lamenesses are difficult to diagnose, when images are difficult to interpret, when we're imaging unusual breeds, it's really, really useful to get the opposite leg, something to act as a bit of a control. I think that's an underutilized approach quite commonly in the radiographs that we get submitted for opinion. When it comes to pharmacologic restraint, sedation or anesthesia, there's obviously a whole range of drugs that you have available, and I'm sure you've all developed your own experience with what works and what doesn't. I just wanted to provide a suggestion for what I've found works in the practices that I've worked at in the past. And metatomidine or dexmedetomidine is a really useful fallback sedative. And in terms of dose, looking at 0.02 milligrams per kilogram of metatomidine when combined with a butorphanol dose of 0.2 milligrams per kilogram given intravenously is really quite a dependable regime. Recently spent time in a practice where they use that metatomidine dose but use a 0.1 milligram per kilogram dose of butorphanol, and I've definitely noticed the reduced effectiveness of that sedation protocol, so I would encourage you to use that higher dose of butorphanol. If you think that the condition is particularly painful, you can switch to butorphanol for methadone. If you're in the middle of an investigation and you're finding that you've got inadequate restraint with that program, then you can add a half dose of the alpha 2, so the metatomidine or dexmedetomidine. Alternatively, you can use intravenous midazolam. The one word of caution when it comes to the midazolam is it will slightly prolong that animal's recovery even after antecedent administration. So be cautious if you've got your client coming a short time after the imaging is being performed. If midazolam is a fallback card, perhaps get someone on the phone to get them to hang out another 60 minutes. When it comes to a protocol for cats, you know, very, very similar. Again, a metatomidine dose of about 0.02 to 0.04 with the addition of an opioid, your opioid of choice. You know, butorphanol and methadone are good fallbacks. If you don't have access to Alfaxan, you know, it's a really nice drug. It results in pretty rapid recoveries. You can give that intravenously. It's also quite useful for really fractious cats where it's very difficult to get, you know, any intravenous access. You can give Alfaxan intramuscularly for short procedures, and that can be a great get-out-of-jail card sometimes. And obviously, you've got your typical induction agents of propofol and thio if that's what you're relying on in practice. We said before that obtaining an orthogonal projection is really useful, and I think it's critical for almost every anatomical area that we're imaging in the orthopedic realm. The reasons that are proposed in cases where orthogonal projections are not obtained, so sort of reasons for why we haven't done that, is often cost. You know, cost is a really common burden and barrier for thorough investigation. All I can suggest is that we look at charging per region rather than per film. You know, set the minimum standard that a stifle radiograph is two views. Don't allow that option of getting a single view, because you will be missing diagnoses. You won't miss them often. You know, it's not going to be every case. It's going to be the rare case where you miss something in the absence of an orthogonal view, and that's when it's really going to matter. You know, it's going to impact the health and welfare of that animal if we miss that information. You know, the other suggestion that I could propose is when it comes to investigating, you know, undefined lamenesses, do it as a package deal rather than, you know, having to pass on the cost of every individual radiograph when we're developing our own knowledge base and trying to get this information. Why don't we provide a package to our clients that allows sort of combined fees, which would incorporate imaging of the entire limb for sort of a fixed and manageable amount. And then imaging the contralateral region, I think it's really useful when it's a vague lameness or a vague concern, and also helps to manage some of these great breed variabilities that we see, you know, some of these crossbreeds and chondrodystrophic dogs. Knowing what's normal is actually really, really challenging, and having radiographs of the opposite leg can definitely help. Stressed views or alternate projections, so alternate positioning, is often handy. The stress radiographs that you're going to obtain in practice, whenever you do that, you really want to image the opposite leg for a comparison, because there are differing degrees of normal laxity that exist in conditions, and having a stress view on the opposite leg is very, very useful. This is a really interesting case that we've had through the practice in recent weeks, and I saw a exact opposite case a couple of months back, whereby a slipped capital physis has developed in this cat. Oopsie daisy. Sorry about that. So a slipped capital physis has occurred. You can see that on that view. And if we look at the comparable leg on the hip extended view, it actually looks not that bad. I mean, there's some irregularity within the femoral neck, but it definitely isn't a clear diagnosis. When we get our frog-legged view versus our hip extended view, then the pathology becomes evident. And I've seen the exact opposite phenomenon occur, whereby we've got a frog-legged view and it looks normal. The hip is and the femoral neck is reduced, and then we go and get an extended view and it becomes displaced. So that's, you know, sort of a nice example of when alternate projection, so extended versus a frog leg, can sometimes add different amounts of information. You know, in the good old days and historically, when we had very good technique, we could get multiple views on a single film, and that was sort of manageable. I'd really warn you against doing that with digital radiography. Whenever you're multiply exposing a single cassette, you're increasing scatter, you're reducing the quality information that you're getting. It also makes image manipulation harder. You know, the position of the image on the screen is very difficult to control when you're putting three or four radiographs on a single cassette. So the cost really shouldn't change for the client. You know, you should be able to cover the costs, whether it's multiple projections on a single film or multiple projections over multiple films. One of the really common sort of inconsistent findings in the radiographs that get submitted for opinion is the way in which these digital images have been manipulated on the screen and submitted. So what I'm referring to is the positioning of the limb, okay? And those fundamentals that you were taught in vet school really should apply in your day-to-day practice. So you want everything to the left of the screen to either be a cranial or dorsal orientation. You want everything to the right of the screen to be a caudal, a palmar, or a plantar orientation. When it comes to the top of the screen, it's either going to be proximal or dorsal in orientation. And then at the bottom of the screen, you want distal or ventral. And that really needs to be consistent. You know, our brains are not well made to look at the vast quantities of information that are coming through in these radiographs. We really struggle to pay attention and to be systematic and focus, and that's a natural human trait. In order to make our job a little bit more easy, we need to be looking at those images consistently. They need to be orientated on the screen in a very familiar manner. I think it's very helpful if you have a series of example pictures in your radiography suite, in your radiography room, that your nurses or technicians and even yourself can have access to, so that before these images digitally are submitted to the PAC system, you're going to manipulate them, make sure they're all consistently orientated on the screen, and then you're going to click send. That way, when they come through to your PACs and your viewing software, you're able to skim through them in a much more efficient manner without having to stop, rotate, and reposition. Obviously, making sure that the left and the right markers are always available and in view, that's important. Some of these digital systems allow for digital cropping before submitting to the PACs. If you're going to crop the images, make sure you crop in the label, left-right label. If the left-right label are incorrect, then a lot of these digital systems have a way which with you can put on a digital template to improve that. So just go through that check. And then there's the use of a calibration marker, and I'd encourage anyone that's got an interest in orthopedics to be going out and purchasing these calibration markers. Later on, I've got some pictures of sort of the ones that I think work best. But the purpose of these calibration markers is to act as a known reference size. So you position it at the level of the bone, and often they're on articulated, movable attachments that you can sort of adjust to the level of the bone. And then it represents a known distance. So, for example, this spherical ball that's been used on the stifle radiograph is a known dimension of 25 millimeters. And so you can adjust your computer software when you're making your measurements pre-surgical to calibrate to appropriate lengths. I've just made this little list, which I think would be useful as a mental checklist, either printed out next to your machine or just something that you think about actively as you're doing these radiographs. Is, have we collimated the image to include the left or right marker? Do we feel that the exposure is appropriate? Do we feel that the exposure is inappropriate? If it's inappropriate, then take it again. Don't try and manipulate it on the screen. Try and improve upon your initial exposure. We want to orientate the image correctly on the screen with those principles mentioned before. This is another one that people often miss, is making sure that the image is not zoomed in when you submit it to your PACs. If you've been looking at the image on your machine, focusing on an area, and then you click OK or submit, when that image goes through to your software in the office, it's going to be automatically zoomed. That's going to be, you know, quite disruptive when it comes to reviewing those images. So before you click submit or OK, pull your image back, make sure that the whole imaged area is on the screen, and then click submit. And if you decide to use a calibration marker, you know, have you used it and is it appropriately positioned? Got a link there to the BCF technology website. I found this recently online, and they've got a really vast array of useful resources for you that are free. They have PDFs of posters you can print off and leave in your exposure suite, which dictate and give you some guides as to tips with regards to positioning. But what I have on this screen at the moment is an exposure chart, and you know, you all should be using exposure charts. If you don't have an exposure chart, then make it a task of one of your keen nurses to take this on board, develop an exposure chart, and make sure that your radiographs in the future are consistent and reproduced. Whenever we're hunting a lameness, we really want to try and get a differential diagnosis list before we begin our orthopedic journey in the x-ray room. A resident that came before me at my residency training in Perth was well known for not having a differential diagnosis list and performing what was termed a safari. So he would go on a orthopedic safari and radiograph everything top to bottom, left to right. And, you know, sometimes that's absolutely necessary. Sometimes having a thorough, systematic and complete approach is very handy. But if you can narrow down to a differential list with specific objectives of your radiographs, that's only going to be more useful in the investigation of that case. Non-localized lameness is you know what I would consider the enemy of orthopedic radiography. It's something that causes great frustration. You know, why is this dog lame? We send it to x-ray and then we really don't have more information afterwards. Part of improving upon that is making sure that we do a really thorough and systematic orthopedic examination, and that's it's a time-consuming process. It can take sort of 30 to 40 minutes to complete a proper orthopedic exam, particularly when you're starting out in your pursuit. And so look at ways in which you can give yourself more time. You know, consider making an orthopedic exam a chargeable admitted procedure. You know, get the client to leave the dog with you for the day. Give yourself time to complete that examination. Often having a nurse that's experienced manipulating the dog and restraining the dog can be very handy. You know, clients are generally pretty hopeless at restraining their own animals effectively. You know, I think that the best way to do a good job is to get a nurse, take your time and be thorough. And obviously a lot of this stuff comes with case experience. You know, your expertise is not something that you can get directly out of a book. It's something that you need to get over time. So if you've got a case where you're not quite sure, you're thinking about doing some investigation, and perhaps you just want another opinion, then chat with a colleague in the practice. Give your local referral center a call. You know, most practices will be more than happy to take a phone call, a couple of minutes to chat about a case, give you some goals, and you might find that you're getting a more rewarding journey as you go through. What if you can't localize it? Well, perhaps we need to get on that safari. But if we're going to go on a safari, we really want to make sure that we're being thorough and not missing anything. So whenever I'm doing a full limb series, I'll always try and do it bilateral, always get orthogonal views, and I'll always make sure that the entire limb is imaged. So if you're focusing on the joints, if you're looking at shoulder, elbow, and carpi of the thoracic limb, it doesn't mean that you don't want to collimate a little bit of the long bones in, and you want to have some crossover between your joints with the long bone exposures. You know, if you've got cases of a pan osteitis or an osseous neoplasia, and you're only focusing on the joint, you may miss that change. It doesn't just stop in x-ray with the x-rays. You know, we want to look at other information that we can get at the same time that might help these vague and difficult to define cases, and joint taps are absolutely your go-to next option. You know, if we have a case in the clinic where a lameness is not becoming apparent on our radiographic investigation, then we'll always take joint taps. You know, I would consider it to be a technically simple technique, something that you will get better at over time the more you do. So practice is really important. And it's also pretty inexpensive. If you decide to look at your slides in-house, you can control the cost of that investigation. One of the sort of adjuncts to arthrocentesis that I've recently discovered, some of you may have known about this for a long time, but what I found quite useful are these test simplets, which you can purchase. They're pre-stained slides. I think they run at about a cost of £1 per slide to the client. You can put a drop of synovial fluid, put a cover slip immediately over that, and then you've got a immediately available slide for review. I would caution you, though, that the stain and cell preservation is quite poor over time. So if you're going to submit this to an external laboratory for verification or for a second opinion, then you might choose to put on a plain slide and let the lab stain it up at their end, because these test simplets are great in-house for quick review, but not great over time. In terms of equipment that you need in the practice. You know, it's everything that's at arm's reach in your treatment room. You just need a small syringe, a 2 or 3 mil syringe is fine. You don't want excessive pressure being generated by a larger syringe. A 23 gauge needle or even a 25 gauge needle is more than adequate in terms of bore diameter. And then, you know, I'd recommend you wear gloves just to try and keep it clean. And an aseptic skin preparation is also important. So you want to prep this just as you would a surgery, but you've only got to clip a very small patch of skin. And then an extension beyond your arthrocentesis is arthrography. You know, if we can take fluid out, then we can put fluid in. And the main value of arthrography in radiographic practice is in the shoulder. It's useful for identifying cartilage defects associated with OC or OCD of the humeral head. We can also see value in diagnosing biceps disease or trauma cases where we might have capsular disruption. So it's quite a useful test. Sometimes it's, you know, as useful as a CT will be. The contrast that you want to have access to is a non-ionic contrast medium, so Omnipaque is probably the most commonly used one. You'll see there in that picture at the bottom that the Omnipaque typically comes at 300 milligrams of iodine per mil, and that's, you know, it's a very, very dense contrast, so you want to use a dilution of that, so dilute it to about 100 milligrams of iodine per mil, and then the volume that you're using really depends on the size of the animal and the joint you're using, but assuming that we're doing the shoulder in sort of a medium to large breed dog, you're probably looking at 3 or 4 mils. Just remember to dilute it, because if it is too dark, you're going to have a poor result. This is a nice case. You can make out on the medial-lateral projection of this, sorry, lateromedial projection of the shoulder, that there's a apparent deficit at the caudal humeral head. If we then go ahead and add some contrast and magnify that up, it now becomes more apparent. We can see that we've got a contrast filling region in there. So we've identified that OC, and that dog needs surgical management ideally. I would also caution you against reusing these vials. They really are single-use vials, the Omnipaque, or at least you want to put a pretty finite time frame on the time that the vials are reused. Ideally, you know, 24 hours is the limit. Most of the time you're using this Omnipaque, you're putting it in you know, sterile environments into joints. You know, might be doing it as a myelogram or as a contrast medium in a bladder. You really don't want the risk of contamination causing a problem. And then you'll all be familiar to a certain degree with your options for sort of advanced imaging. So CT, MRI, scintigraphy, these are all available. And ultrasound, you know, can play a role definitely with musculotendinous inspection also. When you're in a practice and you're busy, you often forget to touch the leg. Definitely I do. I've been at failure, you know, several times of late of failing to touch the leg and missing problems. And I would stress to you that you want to always redirect your arms to the dog and or cat and have a good feel. You know, palpate joint stability. You want to palpate for medial lateral and lateromedial instability, craniocaudal instability, and rotational instability. And even in cases where you know from your exam there's no instability, have a feel. Start to build up your baseline of what's familiar, so that when you find an abnormal case, you've got that reference information to fall back on. You know, we're all familiar with our cranial draw and tibial thrust tests. You know, don't just do that in a dog that has cruciate disease. Go and do that in your normal cases. Really build up your case familiarity and experience. And then the Ortolani test is obviously a valuable test for detecting hip subluxation. And again, you know, do that in as many cases as possible. You'll only get better at that approach. It only adds 30, 60 seconds to your investigation time. Now we're going to move on to technique. A lot of this will be very familiar. You know, I think sandbags are the absolutely the bee's knees when it comes to this investigation. Very useful to rely on. There's a whole range of different sandbags that you can purchase. Foam shapes, all sorts of different shapes are really useful. You know, triangles, wedges, squares, cylinders, have a whole range. Ideally, wrap them in plastic. If you get a cat that has a little leaky bladder and it gets cat urine on your foam wedge, that thing absolutely stinks, and it's quite unmanageable over time. So wrap them in plastic, discard the plastic if it gets soiled, makes for a nice cleanable surface. Our X-ray suites are really contaminated. They're areas where we can pick up post-operative infections quite easily if we don't have good hygiene in that location. So the more that you can do, such as adding plastic disposable bags or cleanable bags on the foam, the better your rooms will be managed. Radiolucent cradles are really useful for our ventrodorsal or our dorsiventral projections of the pelvis and spine. So rely on them as much as you can, and they come in a variety of sizes from all the local distributors. Clearly left and right markers are valuable. I'd always recommend that you've got more than you need because they invariably go missing in the middle of a workup sometimes, and not wasting time trying to find that one marker, is useful. So have a couple spare. Ties are great to have. Tape is really useful. I rely on adhesive tape, particularly that 3M tape. It's fantastically adhesive, and it's really useful for your positioning aid. We talked about the calibration marker before. This is something that we'll go over now. This calibration marker in the top left, so this one just here, this is a really great tool. It's available from a range of distributors. It's about sort of 20, 25 quid. You only need one. It's got a solid metallic base that acts as a point on the table, and it's got this articulated head which you can really adjust to any shape at all. And then it's got a spherical metallic ball of a known dimension. Typically, the dimension is 25 millimeters. And what you can do is, as you're taking your radiograph, you're going to position this ball at the level of the bone so that when the projection comes down, you've got a known magnification, so that you can adjust your software such that the final image is appropriately calibrated. These other calibration tools, particularly the straight tool, is not overly useful because the way that this works is it measures the distance between that ball and that ball. And if there's any angulation in the way that it sits relative to the leg, then we start to get a foreshortening issue developing. So try and stick with the ball design. This is just how we would position it at the level of a stifle. So you can see that the ball is not sitting on the table, it's not sitting above the leg, it's sitting at the level of the bone. Not the soft tissues, but the bone itself, and that gives us a known reference. So we can use this known reference for surgical measurements in theatre. When positioning is proving challenging, we're not quite getting the exposure that we are set out to achieve. Stop, take a step back, and think about what we can change. Often manipulating the chest, going from a left to a right recumbency, or perhaps just into sternal positioning can be enough to help with pelvic limb placement. Also, placing pads underneath the abdomen to manage rotation. They can be wedges or rectangles. We might need to elevate or pad a limb at a certain point. It might not be the limb that we're actually imaging. We might need to elevate or pad the opposing limb just to get that extra bit of rotation necessary for a true view. This is a nice simple technique. If you just have some forceps to manage a tail, which often gets in the way of the femur or the stifle when you're imaging. So have a pair of hemostatic forceps that sit in your X-ray room. Then you just need to clip the tip of the hair to the tip of the hair coat on the body. You're not clipping the bone itself. You're not causing any pain and grief. You're just acting as a little sticky point, and that's much easier to do than trying to put a tie or tape onto the tail. I'm not going to go through the next sort of series of slides in much detail at all. It's really for you to refer to, down the line, just some tips and techniques for positioning and enhancing appropriate exposing. All of this has come directly from the BCF technology website. So if you jump onto that website, you'll find the veterinary component to it very useful, and it's all free and very accessible. So we'll just sort of briefly go through this. A lot of this will be familiar for some of you. If you're ever having trouble, it's worth having access to this. Just have a sit down and go, well, what can I do to slightly improve my positioning? Just stop here for a moment, because the craniocaudal view of the elbow can be a really frustrating view to obtain. Rotation is really common. Elbow dysplasia is really common, and we get a lot of x-rays sent in, and it's really inconsistent with regards to the true CCs that are submitted. One of the things that works quite nicely is to use a triangular wedge underneath the neck, push the head back at an angle, and that often allows our proper positioning of the elbow. Also, having some sort of counter support on the opposing side can be useful as well. Obviously, if you've got a technique that works, then stick with it. So we continue on. These are all just for reference later on. We'll actually go back for a moment and just pay attention to this hip view for a moment. This is the guide from BCF. I actually say that there's some failings with this x-ray. The biggest failing is that we don't have the femoral condyles included within the view. It's actually really important to have your femoral condyles included, less of the lumbar spine, because we're really not doing this VD hip extender view for assessment of the lumbar spine. We're doing it for pelvic and hip joint conformation. If we have the femoral condyles in, then we're able to assess how well positioned the femurs are. And ideally, you want to see a symmetric femoral condyle with the patella sitting in the center. If you don't have that, then you've got inadequate rotation at the level of the stifle, and you need to improve that rotation as best you can to try and get a true view. Anything less than a true view makes assessment of dysplastic conformation very challenging. So this is that frog leg view that we talked about before for the subcapital physis. It's a very simple radiographic view. You really need to do nothing with the legs. The only focus is to make sure that your spine is straight and that your obturator foramen are symmetric. So the main goals are symmetric obturator foramen, dorsospinous trocesis is sitting in the center of the vertebra. If you don't have that, then you've just got to slightly rotate the legs. Most of the time, the rotation actually needs to come at the level of the chest or the abdomen. It's not actually the pelvis itself. It's often further forward that the adjustment needs to be made. I'll also just highlight that I think this is an imperfect stifle radiograph as well. You can see that your femoral condyles are not truly overlying. We've got one sticking out the front and one sticking out the back. Optimally, you want to go for perfect overlap of that. The best way to achieve that is just to adjust under the ankle sometimes, and also to pad underneath the belly, just to lift up the spine a little bit. That can be enough to improve positioning quite nicely. You might think this is a little bit of overkill. There's probably more pads than we need for this case, but just showing that range of options that you should always have available, just to make the efficiency of your investigation greater. So now coming on to some of the errors that we see with digital radiography. There are two artifacts that we see a bit and sometimes get misinterpreted. If you don't remember what an Überschwinger is, at least remember the name, because I'm pretty sure that's the coolest name in the veterinary literature, the Überschwinger effect. And the Überschwinger effect is this lucent halo that develops around metallic implants, and it has to do with the way in which the digital radiograph interprets the image, and it sort of produces this artifact. You need to avoid over-interpretation of lucent halos around metallic implants on digital radiographs. That is a hallmark of an affected or a loose implant, but you need to tie it with the clinical findings and definitely avoid over-interpretation. And then the second artifact that we see is a MAC line, and that's not unique to digital radiography, although it is something that is sort of mistaken on a reasonable frequency when it comes to radial fractures. So these white dots down here just shows sort of the misinterpretation that you may make when the cortical outline of the ulna meets the medulla of the radius. And this dog has had a purposeful oblique osteotomy of its ulna, but it does not extend down here. So that's a typical MAC line which you want to be aware of. There's a great free reference that you can get online about digital radiography artifacts from veterinary radiology and ultrasound. If you just Google that title, you'll get access to that article directly. It goes over some of these artifacts in more detail if you've got interest. Overinterpretation of limb angulation is one of those tricks when it comes to the femur, particularly in cases where we're investigating underlying anatomical causes for patellar luxation, whether it be medial patellar luxation or lateral patellar luxation. When you get your VD extended view of the pelvis, what happens is that the femur appears excessively curved, so we have a apparent femoral varus, and the misinterpretation just comes from the radiographic view itself. If you think about the way that a banana works, when you look at a banana end on, it can appear perfectly straight depending on its position. With a degree of rotation in the same view from in front, same banana, it starts to look very, very bowed indeed, and again bowed. So this is what's happening to the femur. We've just got the femur sort of rotated, presenting an apparent appearance of a varus deficit. If you ever have that suspicion, one of the ways to manage it in practice is perhaps via a horizontal beam technique, if your machine allows for that. We'll go over that in a moment. It does require that your machine head is adjustable. If your machine head is not adjustable, then CT is probably the most reliable resource. Clearly, that's not available in many practices, and sometimes cost will prohibit CT. But in those cases, you're better off to err on the side of caution when it comes to interpreting femoral varus. This is the horizontal beam technique being used in a case of a femoral fracture, just to try and manage some of the foreshortening that occurs with femoral fractures when the pieces develop an angle. And you can see that the tube, the head of the machine, is able to be dropped down low and tilted. And then we've got our X-ray plate sitting in an upright position. If your machine allows for that, that's a really useful technique, particularly good for proximal bones, so bones like the femur and bones like the scapula or the humerus, when you're finding that regional pathology or just body conformation limits the amount of appropriate positioning that you can obtain. And not so much a radiographic error, but perhaps sort of an over-reliance on a tool that's not the best for the job. I think that the use of radiographs and elbow dysplasia has a role, but definitely if CT is a feasible option, you know, you're probably better off to send a case off for CT when elbow dysplasia is suspected as the first-line test, because it's really frequent that radiographs will be obtained of an elbow. You know, nothing will be confirmed. The case will get a CT down the line, and very clearly it'll have a coronoid fragment or an OCD lesion that's been missed. So I think that in those cases, going directly for CT is perhaps the more economic option. Definitely saves, you know, doubling up on investigation tools. Incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle, IOHC, which is a really horrible condition that develops in a lot of spaniel breeds and other breeds less commonly, is a rare beast to accurately diagnose on a radiograph. So if you have a forelimb lameness in a middle-aged Springer Spaniel, and you've got IOH senior list, the odds are that you're going to not identify that on a radiograph when it is going to be identified on a CT. So you might just want to stop and say, well, what is the value of this investigation? Is there a likelihood that I'm going to come away with an accurate diagnosis? Are the clients in a position where CT is feasible? And you know, if that is the case, then perhaps going directly towards that modality would be worthwhile. You know, we talked at the very beginning about the benefits of a diagnostic radiograph, but the reverse to that is, you know, a non-diagnostic radiograph can sometimes lose your client confidence. So making sure that our clients are well educated before we pursue that investigation is going to save disappointment at the end. And somewhat controversially, I would say that radiographing most spinal concerns is really unuseful. You know, radiographs are very rarely diagnostic when it comes to the majority of disc disease that we see, and it's particularly frustrating to get through a complete series of spinal radiographs to come up without an answer. So if there is the possibility to pursue advanced imaging in spinal cases, I would go for that as a first line option. Going to cover some common conditions now, ones that I, you know, see on a regular basis, and you also, I'm sure, will encounter regularly, and perhaps some of the things to look out for. Cruciate disease. How would an orthopedic webinar lecture be complete without discussing cruciate disease? For me, I diagnose cruciate disease on an X-ray far before I see the animal, and that's sort of the nature of the referral environment. An X-ray will be sent in, and I think that it's a really, really useful test, and definitely when instability is not present, when we can't detect the cranial draw or a tibial thrust, then it becomes a radiographic diagnosis in my hands. Okay, if there's evidence of effusion on a radiograph, then that is, for me, a diagnosis until someone proves it isn't a cruciate case. And I guess the only other time when you may have radiographic effusion within a stifle when the cruciate is unaffected would be a polyarthropathy. And, you know, we've discussed arthrocentesis, synovial fluid assessment. That's something that you should be doing on a regular basis. And when combined with a radiograph, it's going to help you get your diagnosis pretty consistently. This is a series of radiographs on the left of a dog with a complete cruciate failure, on the right following a TPLO. What I wanted to sort of highlight was that sometimes the effusion isn't necessarily jumping out at you, although in this case it you know, there is a mild effusion there, but actually the relative position between the femoral condyle and the tibial plateau is really, really bizarre. So, whoopsie daisy, sorry about that. So when you look at the position of the femoral condyle and we look directly underneath, we've got our radiograph optimally positioned. We've got the cranial aspect of the limb sitting to the left of the X-ray. We've got the proximal aspect of the limb to the top of the X-ray. So it's, you know, consistently positioned. We can see that the tibia is sitting away from the underneath the condyle. Following a TPLO, this is the arrangement that should be present. So the tibial plateau should be sitting directly underneath. If you ever see that case, that is just an absolute great case to see, because the owner really understands the significance of that change. I don't want to teach you to suck eggs. Many of this will be, for many of you, this will be very familiar, but you know, the changes that we're looking for, first and foremost, is this effusion change. Okay, so there's an increase in opacity. It's displacing the infrapatellar fat pad, that lucent pacification here, with this whiteness at the front aspect of the joint. So for me, that dog has cruciate disease until we prove it hasn't. We've got osteophytes forming, so we've also got a moderate amount of OA, and then we've also got some enthesiophytes developing at the distal patellar pole, all really hallmark locations for OA in a cruciate case. And then on the right hand side, that image is you know, a pretty normal stifle, really. You know, this is a moderately advanced case. We've got evidence of medial buttress development, which I think you can see radiographically, particularly with some of the exposures we're able to achieve with our digital radiography. And then we've got multiple sites of osteophytosis sort of ticking the box as well. But they are not all cruciate ruptures, and so you need to be prepared to pick out the unusual cases. These are left and right radiographs from the same dog. It's a very unfortunate case. This dog has signs of effusion within his right stifle, so we can see that there's that increased opacification, displacing the infrapatellar fat pad towards the cranial orientation. So this dog's got cruciate disease on the right. But if we start to look at the left, although it doesn't look normal, it doesn't look typical for a cruciate case. We've got a loss of the normal outline to the patella tendon. The distance between the patella and the skin edge is greatly increased if we compare it to the contralateral leg. The appearance within the joint is abnormal, but it's not quite typical for effusion. And in fact, this dog had a synovial pathology going on, which is why it looks bizarre. We won't go through this in too much detail, but if you're reviewing these slides and want to go through that in your own time, it sort of outlines some of those deficits a bit more clearly. Antibrachial limb deformities are, they're a regular beast in practice, and we want to be prepared to understand them a little bit better than simply saying the leg's bent, it's not normal. Complete radiographic assessment of these cases really involves understanding the nature of the deformity and the direct impact on the regional joint, so specifically the elbow and the carpi. And a lot of the time you'll be doing that in your exam. You'll be feeling for carpal restriction, elbow restriction, presence of elbow or carpal pain. But when we're doing our radiographic interrogation, we want to be able to understand those deformities from a corrective purpose, but also just from an understanding perspective. And in order to do that, not to harp on too much, but again, we want to go orthogonal, so two views. We always want to get x-rays of both legs for comparison. And very commonly, we've got rotation. We've got a rotation at the level of the carpus. And if we have rotation, then we need to make specific projections to define that deformity more accurately. This x-ray that you can see is a good example of a radiograph documenting that the leg's not right, but really doesn't help us understand why it's not right. We don't have a true craniocaudal of the carpus. We don't have a true craniocaudal of the elbow. We've just kind of got an antebrachium sitting in an imperfect position. What we do in these cases, and what I'd recommend and advocate that you do in every case like this, is to try and get true craniocaudal views and mediolateral views, focusing on the elbow, and then focusing on the carpus. So you're going to end up obtaining four radiographic projections per leg, two legs, so you're going to have eight radiographic projections, assuming that the first time you take it is accurate, so you might need to repeat a few. So this is a true elbow straight, so we've got a true craniocaudal of the elbow. You can see that the femoral condyle appears symmetric. And then when we look down at the wrist, we've got rotation. So we're going to correct for that rotation with our next x-ray. Now we're going to have a true craniocaudal of the wrist. That's a familiar view for us, but we've got obliquity occurring at the elbow, and that's okay. We're now able to define that deformity because we can knit those two x-rays together and make a more accurate assessment. Practically speaking, it's very simple to do. You're just going to focus on the elbow in one view, and I'm going to make slight adjustments and focus on the carpi for our second one. Elbow dysplasia, times where radiographs are useful. It's a very useful test for diagnosing ununited anconeal process. It's perhaps a good test to start assessing for incongruity, particularly in cases where growth plate trauma have occurred or with chondrodystrophic dogs. It is, however, a really insensitive tool when it comes to the most common cause of elbow dysplasia, which is a fragmented or fissured coronoid process. It's also not an optimal tool for OCD deficits in some cases as well. CT, as I said before, is probably the go-to test if that's available. If you do decide, though, that you're going to go ahead with the radiographic series, which is, a perfectly legitimate thing to do, what you want to do is make sure that you include proximal and distal to the elbow, because in these animals, these juvenile pets, pan osteitis is a regular feature, so we want to be assessing for those. These radiographs on the left are, your very typical pan osteitis appearance. And then also when it comes to the humeral head OCD lesion, so proximal humeral head, getting a medialateral view of the shoulder is quite useful, particularly in those cases where perhaps they might have multi-joint problems, could have both elbow and shoulder dysplasia evident. This is a nice case that was submitted to the practice not long back of a UAP diagnosis. This radiograph is actually not sort of perfectly positioned for assessing the Ankinil process because we've got sort of a moderate degree of elbow extension. We actually want more flexion evident, but despite that, it's a diagnostic radiograph for a UAP. And on the opposite side, the contralateral limb, we can see that that's normal. The Ankinil process in the majority of dogs should have fused by about 16 up to sort of 20 weeks of age in large breed dogs. So at 20 weeks of age, we can pretty accurately assess the Ankinil process fusion. You might send your elbow radiographs off for opinion every so often, and the common phrase that's returned with these early FCP cases is there's subtrochlear sclerosis. So that subtrochlear sclerosis, that sort of area is an increased opacity at this location adjacent to the coronoid, and it reflects the biomechanical behavior of the elbow to that pathology, whereby it lays down a denser and more opaque bone as a consequence to the changes in load distribution. So that's often the first hallmark sign. The elbows that we have on the projection at the moment are actually moderately arthritic elbows, showing a lot of the pretty typical signs of osteophyte formation. We've got osteophytes at the cranial aspect of the radial head. We've got some mineralization near the epicondylar ridge. We've got pretty pronounced subtrochlear sclerosis, all ticking the hallmarks of elbow OA. Patellar luxation, it's usually detected on your clinical exam for various reasons. You might have missed it or it might not have been evident. And sometimes you can pick these up on your radiographs. If you've got a medialateral view, just have a look at the position of the patella relative to the femoral condyles. There should be no overlap. So this x-ray on the left hand of your screen is normal. This x-ray on the right demonstrates patellar instability. Crest, tibial tuberosity, and make decisions about how much back from the crest you're going to make your cup for an osteotomy. It's nice when you're starting out to have those numbers in your or head for intraoperative execution of your plan. Another nice little pickup is if you are going to assess the femur. We talked about femoral varus and rotation before. X-rays are an imperfect tool, but not to be unused. This appearance here, this double condyle sign, you've got a normal-looking femur at the proximal aspect, but the femoral condyles aren't overlapping on this right image. That suggests that there's some degree of rotational or varus deformity of the femur that may be contributing to the patellar luxation. And then these views on the right, one being a true craniocaudal projection obtained with the horizontal beam, the other one being a CT reconstruction, we can measure specific angulations of the femur for surgical planning. Spinal disease, I mentioned before that I think that plain radiography is not a particularly useful tool. That's not always the case. There are some roles for it, but when it comes to investigating intervertebral disc disease, it has a very limited place in your armoury. Many of the radiographic features that indicate chronic disease, so the most typical one being our spondylosis forming ventrally, that often is completely insignificant when it comes to effects on the spinal cord. myelography or advanced imaging, CT, MRI are really critical in these cases. If you're trying to identify a cause of a vague spinal pain, you're going to find plain radiography to be highly unrewarding. And it's also, a moderately expensive test as well. To do it properly, it's time consuming. You need to be constantly moving the animal to focus the center of the beam at the area of interest. You need multiple projections. It's important to get your orthogonal view. And you start to really rake up some costs when it comes to this. I'd suggest that you're probably better off sending these cases off for advanced imaging, either directly to an imaging center or via a referral center if that's available, if we're trying to do the best for that pet. When is spinal radiography useful? It is sometimes useful. You may pick up osseous neoplasia, although, as a phenomenon, that's pretty rare. And even in cases where we've had CT confirmed and biopsy confirmed tumours of the vertebra, the radiographs have been pretty unremarkable. There needs to be a lot of destruction of the vertebral architecture before it becomes really apparent on a radiograph. Discospondylitis, that's definitely a scenario where you're going to pick that up in some cases on radiographs. So if that's at the top of your list or near the top of your list, radiographs are definitely useful. Some fractures and luxations, it's definitely the go-to test to start, and some congenital deformities as well. It is important to stress, though, that plain radiographs tell you nothing about cord behavior. It doesn't tell you whether you've got interference with your spinal canal. Pelvic trauma, we're nearly to the end. Thanks for sticking in with us. Not many slides left now. This is something that you can look at in a bit more detail at the end, but when it comes to pelvic trauma, I always think about the pelvis as being a box. We're all taught that in vet school. So if we've got one disruption evident, we've probably got a pair that we've missed. Okay, the only times where we might have independent fractures in the absence of partners in crime is in the greyhound acetabulum fracture, which is quite unusual. The racing greyhound is at risk of a repetitive stress fracture propagating through the acetabulum. And then when we've got bilateral sacroiliac joint luxations, the whole pelvis can shunt cranially without any actual disruption at other sites. Always have your eye in trauma cases when you're assessing the sacroiliac joint. I always do a deliberate mental process of looking at the sacrum, making a second look at the inner border of the ileal body. And then when it comes to a pathologic case where there's only minor displacement, that starts to become something that you pick up quite quickly. So training your eyes to follow that sacroiliac junction is very useful. And then with your spinal cases, sometimes we're so fixated on watching the box of the pelvis that we actually forget to focus on the sacrum. And the sacrum is really critical when it comes to neurologic function to the bladder and pelvic limbs in some cases, predominantly, control over urination. So sacral fractures are something that you want to pick up early because they often have a significant prognostic impact in traumatic cases. Just finishing up now with enhancing our second opinions. We said earlier that expertise comes with case experience and we only get case experience over time. When you're looking for a second opinion, you may be looking in-house, you may be looking out of house. You've got a range of options for places to refer these images to. I think it's really important that you recognize the huge difference between DICOM images, JPEG images, and photographs of radiographs. Photographs are clearly the most limited way in which an image can be submitted. Sometimes you're forced into that in emergency cases where you just need an opinion, ASAP. But ideally, pursuing a DICOM submission is the way to go. DICOM is just an acronym. It sort of stands for Digital Imaging and Communication and Medicine. And these files are large files, and they're large files because they maintain all of the original data that the digital machines obtained. whenever you convert a DICOM to a JPEG, you instantly lose the ability to easily window the picture. You lose some of the patient data as well, and it really is an inferior method of submitting your radiographs. Teleradiology services, for example, VetCT, which I do a little bit of telemedicine consulting with, they are not happy to accept anything but a DICOM image. And I think that's a very good sort of line in the sand to draw. Often your referral centres are a little bit more lax about them, but you know, preferably submitting DICOMs were the way to go. If you are going to submit JPEG, if that's something that you have to do for the individual case, make sure that you haven't magnified on the picture when you click transfer to JPEG, because if you've got it magnified on your screen, you transfer it to a JPEG, then it arrives at the second opinion as a magnified image, and often the original radiograph is lost completely, and that just ends up delaying the opinion that you get when you have to get that rectified. When it comes to your options, you know, I think having a good relationship with your regional referral centre is paramount. That's a really important port of call to begin. And then your other options are online teleradiology services. There's a range available. You need to be wary about the person interpreting your image. You know, you've got your sport for choice. You've got the options of surgeons, and you've got the options of images. Looking at these images, the different expertise come to different conclusions. We all have our own independent biases as well. If it's a case where referral is likely, I would probably begin with your local referral centre, because you don't want to convolute the story by getting the opinion of someone that actually isn't going to be actively involved in the case management. Just our final slide now. You know, this seems so simple, but you know, the quality of the information that goes into the investigation really has a direct relationship to the quality of the information that comes out. And the same happens when you're submitting these radiographs for opinion. Take a few minutes. You know, I know everyone's got very busy days, and this is a time-consuming process. And often, you know, you're really not charging enough for the time that it takes. But pay a few minutes to write a concise history. If a concise history arrives at the image interpretation service, then the quality of the interpretation is generally enhanced. If you provide just a PDF copy of the history with nothing sort of focused, then often you lose the attention of the reviewer, and you know, a limited quality interpretation is generated. And again, when you're submitting these images, go back to your principles. Make sure that the radiographs are appropriately positioned so that the interpretation is accurate and consistent. Thanks very much. That's great. In terms of questions, we've got a couple of questions that have come through, and one of those questions is just with regards to positioning for the ventral dorsal hip extender view, and whether I've got any suggestions for trying to improve that. Definitely something that is quite hard to do consistently. If I just go back a little bit. I might just try and show on one of these. Suggestions. Nearly there. So, whoopsie daisy, we overshot it. So one of the things that I found works really, really nicely when it comes to positioning for a ventral dorsal hip extender view is to use that 3M elastoplast tape or something equivalent. It really needs to have a very adherent nature. It doesn't want to break easily. It's going to be under some tension. And to take that tape and to wrap it on the top part of the thigh, proximal to the stifle, and then you're going to wrap that around the inside of the leg, okay, adhering to the coat. going to be underneath the leg, underneath the leg immediately proximal to the stifle. Then you're going to come over the top. So you've now done a full 360 degrees wrap around of the distal femur, and then you're going to continue with that tape and tape it to the table. Okay, so you're creating a little bit of a cross. You're going to reverse that exact process. So starting at the top of the thigh above the stifle, you're going to wrap underneath the leg 360 degrees around, and then you're going to zoom that tape back up and over, tape it to the table, and often that gets that appropriate internal rotation of the stifle, which is really, really important when it comes to proper positioning. If that's not quite enough, if you've got a really muscular dog and you're struggling to still get that position appropriately, then take a third strip of tape and tape around both legs. You can do that with the Velcro. You can use the 3M tape as well. But that often is a really nice technique. Sometimes the legs come together closely and you end up getting angulation developing in the femurs. So when you do your third bit of tape or your Velcro around the thighs, just put a bit of foam padding in the middle just to, sort of to get the femur straight. I think that's a really nice technique that can definitely help in those struggling cases. Just got a second question coming through now. There's not a huge amount of active attendance today just with the timing, so that's the only one that's come through now. It just has to do with the value of radiographs and elbows, and the question is whether, you know, I'm advocating that we don't do a radiographic investigation of an elbow case if CT is available. No, not necessarily. I don't think that not investigating the elbow radiographically is necessarily my point, but I think you need to appreciate the limitation of your radiographs. You know, We see a large number of elbow dysplasia cases referred through the hospital, and of those cases, you know, 80 to 90% will only be diagnosed following computed tomography. You know, it's a really essential modality when it comes to diagnosing fragmented coronoid process disease. You know, sometimes we'll go directly to arthroscopy when cost is a bit of a limiting feature, but CT is definitely most reliable. You know, the BVA scheme for elbow dysplasia doesn't look at CTs. You know, they rely on, you know, these standard views of the elbow, this flex lateral and this extended lateral view. And there is still a role for that. But I think you do need to educate your clients as to the limitation of that tool when elbow dysplasia is suspected. And, you know, these radiographic investigations, sometimes we can spend $300, $400, $500. And if we're going through that sort of money, inevitably having to do a CT scan, then perhaps it's not money well spent. I guess the reverse side of that is if you investigate it and everything looks normal and the clinical signs resolve, then perhaps that was, you know, useful peace of mind for the client. But no, I'm not saying that not radiographing the elbow is the way to go, but instead just understanding the limitations of that and in which cases it's going to be useful. That's about it.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lucas for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.